You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Times Square, the Statue of Liberty, Central Park are familiar destinations for both tourists and New Yorkers. But forget about asking someone where they might find the Garbage Museum or the grave of the Matinacock Indians. Luckily, writer and photographer T.M. Reeves has now revealed some of the city's strangest and best-kept secrets in two of his books, Secret New York, An Unusual Guide, and Secret New York, Curious Activities. They are published by Jungles, and I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Reeves to our show. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
And we invite our listeners to share some of their Secret New York knowledge. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692. Write us on our show page at WNYC.org and join, or you can join us on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. You're not a native New Yorker. How long have you been here?
I'm coming on 10 years now.
Do you think that being from somewhere else is why you became interested in finding all of these relatively obscure places?
Yes, I do, for sure. The zeal of the convert. But one thing that I do is when I find a place that seems to me to be have something in secret about it, I'll ask a native, and that's sort of my... That's my metric for whether or not it's worthy.
And what happens more often than not to say, oh, there's a place like that? Because, for example, one of the places you list here, the American Numismatic Society, is just down the street from WMYC Studios. And I'm willing to bet that if you asked anybody in this building where it is, they wouldn't know.
Exactly. Well, one of the things about New York is that you're talking about a very specific case that is the verticality. You can be walking on the street and have no idea what's above your head. The Numismatic Society is kind of a funny little example because it should be much, much more famous.
We're at 160 Varick and it's at 75 Varick. It's really close.
To tell you the truth, I'm talking historically because this was supposed to be part of a gigantic museum complex uptown, Washington Heights, that never got off the ground. It was supposed to be the Geographical Society, the Numismatic Society. Right now there's the Hispanic Museum up there. Mm. And it got kind of kicked around, and now it's on the 11th floor of a building, and you can go there and see the world's best collection of coins.
You're a photographer. I would assume that that's one of the reasons you look for these places. But how do you find a place that is on, what did you say, the 11th floor?
Well, that I was led to through research on other things. I became very interested in early New York history, and specifically this tall tale about Manhattan being bought for wampum, which was this Native American
$24.
That's
worth
right.
Of wampum.
60 guilders or $24. This has been fixed for eternity at $24 for absurd reasons. Probably never happened that way. It probably wasn't the, you know, that wasn't the proper exchange. But this wampum did exist, and I wanted to see some real wampum. And so I tracked down a guy who could show it to me.
And what does wampum look like?
It looks like little purple beads about a half inch long. And it's drilled from clamshell, a specific clam that they used only for this.
But of course, New York Harbor was just filled with clams and oysters at the time.
And at the time, it was filled with oysters that are gone now. Hmm. They were like dinner plates. They were enormous. The main source of protein for the Native Americans on Manhattan was oysters.
Now, the wampum, I'm assuming, was used in trading with the Dutch because you've revealed that the Dutch counterfeited wampum.
This is one of my favorite little details. I love that they had the ingenuity, and I hate that they had the that kind of brash pluck to counterfeit the local currency.
Well, let's cheat those Indians.
Exactly, they were really good at porcelain, and they were great at faking Chinese porcelain, and they just sort of exported those skills.
Now, should we call wampum quasi currency?
Yeah, quasi-currency
is... Are there other quasi-currencies at the American Numismatic Society?
Yes. In fact, the guy, Richard Hogue, the man who showed this to me, showed me his favorite piece of currency in the entire place, which now has become, for me, a symbol of how weird currency is in itself. A gigantic ring, you could think of it as a stone donut that's about 2 feet in diameter, although they can be a dozen feet in diameter, from the island of Yap. And he said... It's a South Pacific, I think. And he said, this thing is so strange that...
Yaplanders live there.
There you go. it's all of the Yaplanders come from the island of Yap. He said that when they used to make land deals with these things, and at one point there was a famous instance where they dropped one in the bay, and they continued to use it because everyone knew it was still down there. You couldn't put your hand on it, but the money's down there. So we'll continue to use it to trade. And so it just gives you an idea of how different you can think about currency and exchange.
Are you all at all concerned that giving away these hidden gems will make them less special, no longer a secret?
I agonized at the beginning, and then I realized that there's a certain flavor that I find I can't get on board with, and that's the exclusive, not for tourists thing. This I find mean-spirited, and I don't think it goes anywhere. I think that it's just exclusive.
Well, you're from California, which also has a long history, but not as long as New York's. How does California compare to New York in terms of oddities and strange historical artifacts?
I think I haven't lived in California for 20 years, a little bit more. And the reason I left, when I left, I decided to go long. I went to Europe because I wasn't finding what I find here, and that is a kind of living fabric of history.
Europeans seem to be more aware of their history, partly because they've had a much longer history.
They think they are. I can tell you some funny stories. I lived in Venice, Italy for a while, and you'll always come across a Venetian who will tell you, you know, this building was put up in, and then they'll just make up a date. But they're the arbiter because it's their patrimony, so they get to tell you when it was made. They're off by 500 years, but it doesn't matter.
My guest is T.M. Reeves, R-I-V-E-S. He has two books out called Secret New York, An Unusual Guide and Secret New York Curious Activities, both published by Jungles. What's the story behind the Netherlands Monument flagpole?
Well, we were talking before about the exchange of wampum for the island of Manhattan. This is sort of the ground zero of that, as in something that you can see in the history of the city, that it's kind of the fountainhead of this myth, if you like, visually. It is a settler handing a handful of beads to a Native American. And this was a gift in 1906 for the 400 years of the discovery by Hudson.
A gift by the Dutch government?
By the Dutch. And
but they got things wrong. The Indian is wearing a Plains Indian war bonnet.
This is more frequent than you could imagine. People just imagine that all Indians had a war bonnet. And one of the things that they did in 1915 when they standardized the city seal was say, enough of this war bonnet stuff. An Algonquin used to wear two feathers pointing up, and he had a mohawk probably type hairstyle, but never this ridiculous Hollywood Indian full platter array of feathers.
Now, is the monument at the site that is assumed to have been where the exchange took place?
This is something that's flipped a couple of times. People always said that it happened down there because, well, that was the major Dutch settlement. It was in the Battery. And then they started to say that it happened up in Inwood. And you can find a plaque in Inwood that says here is the site of the... And then they later found out that that's actually just another myth on top of a myth. No one knows exactly for sure, but it's certainly downtown near the Battery somewhere.
And it seems to me that it's unlikely that any money would have been exchanged from Manhattan Island or the five boroughs because Indians didn't think anybody owned land.
I'll just give you just one example of exactly that. Staten Island was sold, quote unquote, five times. Enough said.
To the person who bought the Brooklyn Bridge.
There you go. It's a long history of that.
You also have an entry about a grave marker of the Matinacoc Indians. Who were they?
The Matinacoc were a tribe. People don't like the word tribe for Long Island. They were a group of Indians. Tribes, you could say that they were, if they exist as a name, then it's a group that exists as a tribe. And they're all over Long Island. You can find them in the map. You see the names. The Matinacoc they had the kind of the special indignity of having their last graveyard dug up to lay down a four-lane street. So when they did that, they moved.
Robert Moses did this to them?
I don't think it was Robert Moses. I think it was a little bit before.
Oh, I blame him for everything.
Oh, we'll talk about him later. I've got a good Robert Moses entry in the book for you. But they disrupted them, and then they gave him a grave marker, which was the symbol of their group.
How did you hear about that one?
To tell you the truth, I do not recall. I read so many books and did so much kind of sporadic research that sometimes it slips.
Well, a lot of the stories are about the Indians. You write about another case of uprooting, the village of Seneca.
Yes, Seneca is a very compelling story. Seneca was a very successful, by all accounts, community of mostly African Americans, although there were some Irish and there's some admixture of some other groups, in Central Park, about what would become Central Park. They were about at the height of the low 80s, from 82 to 86. I may be wrong. Anyway, you can see one sort of sun bleached and cracked sign at Central Park that makes a mention of this place. What's very striking is that Central Park is one of those places that has just been carved out in geometry. Someone said, "We want a gigantic rectangle here. Make it so." And there were people there. The people in Seneca had moved up there to escape horrible prejudice and actually also airborne diseases and things, and they were very happy. Two churches, one school, everything gone in 1854.
How was it discovered?
They always knew it was there. The big mystery is where these people went. There is no record of the names, where they went, where they ended up. And there was a little excavation 2 years ago.
Central Park is largely a construct. What about the boulders that are located throughout the park? Were they brought in?
I love these things because they're so easy to ignore. And this gets to exactly the heart of what I consider a good secret, because this is the sort of thing that you can walk by. You don't take any notice at all, but you're standing next to something with an amazing history, and something that kind of puts New York in a much broader historical tableau. And these things were brought over by glaciers, so you have these. You can see them almost immediately because they're generally a little bit more pinkish. All of Manhattan, except for in the north where there's a little bit of marble, is a stone called schist. That's the ground. That's the bedrock. So when you see on a gigantic pink boulder sitting on top of bedrock, and this boulder is 20 tons, you can walk by and just say, well, there's a boulder. But ask yourself, how on earth did that get there? And the way that it got there was 12,000 years ago, it had been scooted down by a glacier, which then melted and left no trace of its delivery system.
So it's a boulder sitting on top of the schist.
That's exactly it, yeah.
Now we have buildings sitting on top of the schist.
Yeah.
Although the schist is not consistent throughout Manhattan. At Chambers Street, it ends for a while, and then it picks up again closer to Midtown.
Just 2 years ago, a very popular New York myth was dispelled when they discovered that the depth of the soil before you get to bedrock has never been any deterrent to building a large building. The reason that there are buildings in Midtown and then buildings downtown is almost purely economic.
Although I heard that the building we used to be located in, the municipal building, was planned to be larger, and they discovered that they were on the edge of the schist, and McKim, Mead, and White then modified their plans.
That could be there. That's an area you're getting really close to the east side there. They might be talking about more.
It's right near the Brooklyn Bridge.
Yeah, no, it might be because there's a lot of landfill there. That's Manhattan was widened at that section. So they might be talking about not the depth, but they might be talking about the breadth.
We invite our listeners to join in the conversation in case you know about any hidden secret places that we should know about. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or join in on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. My guest is T.M. Reeves, R-A-V-E-S. His two books, Secret New York, An Unusual Guide, and Secret New York, Curious Activities, both published by Jongles, J-O-N-G-L-E-Z. Stay with us for more. We are back with a look at Secret New York. We've been talking about two books written by T.M. Reeves, Secret New York, Curious Activities, and Secret New York, An Unusual Guide. And they are both published by Jongles, J-O-N-G-L-E-Z. And we are inviting your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Before we get to the calls, since we were talking about Seneca, the disappearance of Seneca also coincides with the construction of the Croton Aqueduct system. How did that project come about?
Manhattan just didn't have any good source of fresh water. This has been linked to a lot of interesting little cultural phenomena. For example, alcoholism. The temperance movement was wedded to this water delivery movement because one of the cleanest things you could drink was any form of ale or alcohol. So Manhattan needed water. The cisterns weren't working anymore. Rainwater wasn't enough. So they came up with a crazy scheme of Egyptian magnitude. And to really, to give you an example of how what they thought of it, they built an enormous water reservoir where the Manhattan Public Library is now on Fifth Avenue that was that echoed Egyptian architecture. And so they just brought this, basically rerouted a river from 40 miles north.
Well, New York is, Manhattan is supposed to be filled with streams and brooks. Were they feeding it?
No, they weren't. And in fact, for a long time, there was a long tradition of whenever you saw a nice little stream or a brook, you would throw dirt and garbage into it to cover it up so that you could build something on top of it. If you look at a map from the mid-1800s before, you will see an amazing array of springs.
The aqueduct was where the library is, but what about the reservoir in Central Park? Did that come afterward?
No, that's part of the same system.
Mm-hmm. Now it's just a place that people run around. Does it still supply water?
It's intended to be an emergency reservoir, but I can't remember. If you go to Central Park, and I really recommend you do this because there's some really great information that you can get there. They have these public signs that give you a number that you can call, your cell phone, and it will tell you a little bit about the place where you're at. The one at the reservoir will tell you that if Manhattan ran out of water, that reservoir would last. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it's ridiculous. Something like, you know, if 14 hours or something.
Well, luckily, we have a wonderful system that is further upstate. Let's take some calls. Our number here, 212-433-9692. Lewis from Washington Heights. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I was thinking of the little red lighthouse right under the George Washington Bridge.
I love this thing. I thought it was maybe a little tiny bit too well known to put in my first book, but then I bit anyway because it's really one of the most lovely things that you can see. As you probably know, I'm sure they know, the Little Red Lighthouse was the subject of a children's book. Now, this will maybe change the way you think about Robert Moses because this lighthouse was supposed to be destroyed because it no longer served any function. And the children's book is about the anxiety of this lighthouse being no longer needed because there was the George Washington Bridge and there was a lot more light, a lot more traffic, so it didn't serve anymore. Children lost their minds about this, that it was going to be destroyed, so they sent in change and they sent in letters and they sent in pleas, and they were listened to by
Robert Moses, who then cut a highway through the Bronx and did all sorts of other things.
We're not going to, you know, yeah. I think, well, let's just give him that one.
Yeah, no, he did some very good things, Riverside Park, for example.
Right.
But can you go to the lighthouse? Can anyone gain access?
You certainly can, and anyone who likes the idea of riding all the way up the Riverside Park, you just mentioned, on a bike, and then just heading up as far as they like, will find that they get hung up at the little red lighthouse, and they have to head inland for a stretch. You can go there directly from south of Manhattan. It gets a little bit twirly and messy once you get there.
But you can just cross over without having to go on a boat?
No, I mean, it's on the shore. It's on a little hook of land. And no, it's right. It's nestled directly under the George Washington Bridge.
How many of the hidden treasures are free?
So many. The lion's share. There are some that I allowed myself a couple of... just to make a distinction, the first book is Secret Places. None of those cost anything. You just have to have a pair of eyes and the willingness. The next book, Curious Activities, involves things that you do. So some of these cost money. Most of them don't. I think probably three quarters of them cost a thing. Some of them are a little bit luxurious if you feel like you deserve it.
Let's take another call. This one's from Lola from the Upper East Side. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. This is so exciting because I listened to this show religiously for years and years and years. Anyway,
and this is your first call.
I'm a photographer, and I often choose places to wander and photograph and get to learn. And somewhere during the 70s in my travels, I was in Lower Manhattan, took a photograph of a sign near a chain link fence, and the street sign said Republican Alley. I have no idea. I have not been able to trace this in any book of streets or street names, and perhaps your guest knows where this is.
There were Republicans in New York City at one point?
It's...
It must have been a very short point.
This sounds like a myth to me. I don't know. I'm sorry to say, I'm not sure what that is.
It was just, you know, your normal street sign walking around in Lower Manhattan, and I just noticed it was kind of fun to take the photo because it said, and a legitimately printed New York City street sign, Republican Rally.
I don't know what that is, but you have to be a little bit suspicious of the officially printed street signs here because sometimes people have fun with them, and this is a favorite little side subject for me. For example, the Department of Transportation, if you are on Fifth Avenue and you go past the Rockefeller Center, you will see a sign, and I love this. I think this is really an only in New York kind of sign. It says, "Don't even think about parking here." And below it says, "Department of Transportation." Like they,
and rather than no parking at
that's
any
right.
time.
That's right. And the think is the largest word on the sign.
Thank you for calling us, Lola. Seth from Rockaway. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. Hi. I remember seeing something on television a couple of months back about underneath the Waldorf Astoria, there's actually a rail spur that has been there since the beginning of time, but there's a artifacts from a rail car that was used by FDR.
That's
and
right.
All this stuff is still there. It's still controlled by the MTA.
Yes, and I would if I knew how to get down there and take pictures of it, if someone could tell me, I welcome it. I tried. I couldn't get there. You're correct. It's still there, and you can go online and see photos of this.
But yeah. But you don't know how to get down there. There is a hidden subway entrance, isn't there?
Yeah,
somewhere?
That's what they say, and they say that this is often called the Roosevelt Station. It comes up now and again in the movies, for example, when they need a kind of a secret spooky place.
So that I'm
fascinated with. It's known. It's been photographed. It's been documented. I'm much more interested in there's supposedly from the Tilden Mansion on the south of Gramercy Park. There's a tunnel that goes several blocks straight south because he was paranoid about, in the end of his life, he was troubled. And so he had this tunnel built. There's one that I'd like to see a photo of.
But nobody can go in there anymore?
I couldn't get to first base with the people.
Let's take another call. Elizabeth from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. You know, I'm calling about the little farmhouse on Charles Street, which was moved from the upper east side, I believe, in the 60s, and now it's Mary Manning Walsh Nursing Home, and it's supposed to have been the oldest in Manhattan, and it's at 161 Charles Street.
In the West Village, not far from here as well.
Right.
And it is also, it was moved with pomp and circumstance, and Percy Hutton and God knows who took it down from the Upper East Side.
And please.
Sorry. And now I have heard that it's about to be destroyed, and I'm very sorry to hear that.
I haven't heard that it's going to be destroyed. One of the things that I one rule that I gave myself is that I wanted to explore things that were only in situ, and except in certain cases like the Alexander Hamilton's house, which is famous because it's Alexander Hamilton's. That was moved a couple of times. So when I found out something was moved, I tended to move on myself.
This is a part of New York history that things get destroyed. Before we go any further with that, my guest is the author of two books, Secret New York, Curious Activities, and Secret New York, An Unusual Guide. He's T.M. Reeves, R-I-V-E-S. The books are published by John Gliss, and should point out that not only are they listings of the various things that he has discovered, but he also has photographs accompanying them. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. One of the great treasures most people talk about, the sad destruction of, was Penn Station. The Eagles that were on that station are around somewhere, aren't they? Much of it was buried in, as I understand, the marble and all in New Jersey in the
that's
swamps.
Right. That kind of kicked off the whole preservation, the landmarks movement. I think it was based on one photograph, someone who had photographed an angel from the exterior of Penn Station. Just a note, it took years to demolish all of the beauty that they had constructed at Penn Station. Just to give you an idea of how magnificent this place was, just to tear it apart took years. But they found an angel carving upside down and tilted in a landfill in New Jersey. Someone took a picture of it, and this is what kind of shocked people. They realized, sure, it's part of being in New York City. Destruction goes with creation, we all know.
Has it been brought back?
No, I tried to track down with Seaworth if I could find one of these eagles. There are two that are noted in the book that are on display that you can see in front of the current Penn horror that is Penn Station. The interesting thing about them, they don't have any plaque. They don't have any attribution at all. People don't talk about walking by not knowing what you're seeing.
Among the strangest natural phenomenon in your book are the Kentucky coffee trees. Now, why are they called Kentucky coffee? First of all, coffee comes from the Mideast, and as far as I understand it, these trees are actually from the Midwest, but we have some here in New York?
You are consistently picking all of my favorite things. It's uncanny. I have a fetish problem with this tree. I carry a seed in my pocket. I'm fascinated with this because it is, long story short, this is a tree that the seeds of which the mastodon used to eat when they lived in the area 12,000 years ago. There's a delay in evolution, or there's a delay in natural history where the tree survives because it ekes out an existence, but it's missing the thing that used to disperse its seeds. So this
because
is
it's poisonous.
It's poisonous to everything.
Birds would die. Anyone else would die, but mastodons didn't die when they ate it.
One of my favorite.
They died from other things.
One of my favorite little facts of this is they've given, apparently, if you give the seed pod to a cow, you can knock it down. And I thought, was this something enzyme, or is this something, there's a digestive chemical that the mastodon has that keeps it from getting poisoned? And the funny thing is, it's just so big, it doesn't make a difference. But the reason it's called coffee is during the Civil War, there was an interesting article in the Times not too long ago about the Civil War is really fueled by coffee. And the South was desperate to have it, and the North lorded it over them and they could get it. And people would try to make coffee out of anything, even breadcrumbs and burnt corn cobs. And they discovered that the seeds, if you roast them, they make a pretty good
artificial. And they lose
coffee.
Their poison.
They lose their poison when you roast them for an hour.
Now, where would I find some Kentucky coffee trees?
You can find two of them, or two little tiny stand of them. I think there may be three in Central Park. You can find one on West 70th Street between Amsterdam and West End. You can find one in Inwood. If you like it later, I can draw you a map.
Well, of course, people can find those locations in your book as well. One entry that I found fascinating is the sensory deprivation chamber, the blue light flotation in Chelsea. Now, do people go there to be deprived?
People have been depriving their senses there for 30 years. This is a man who had his inroads into what they call flotation, sensory deprivation. It was Eastern meditation, and he's been doing it for decades. And I don't like to doll it up too much. What this is literally is it's a tub in a man's apartment. It's very.
What was the experience like for you? You sit in a closed space in a tub.
You sit.
I've done that in some very small apartments.
I'll tell you the difference. What you're trying to do is you are trying to make as neutral as possible your sensory experience. So it's, of course, completely dark. It's soundproof. The water is 94 degrees. Very important, because that's not the temperature of your body, but that's the temperature of your skin. And it's loaded with salts so that you float. Now, after about 10 minutes of that, you lose track of where your mind ends and your body begins. You really have no sensation. The only problem is that you can hear your own body functions. Your heart becomes very interesting, for example. You can hear yourself blink.
Because it's so silent, quiet.
Yeah.
Does this cost money?
It does. It costs $80, I think.
$80 to hear my heart go. Okay.
For longer sets, for an hour. For a longer session, a little bit more.
There's also the garbage museum. What kinds of objects I keep in a garbage museum? I probably have a few things I could donate.
You say what kinds of objects, and for me this cuts right to the heart of what's so magical about this place, is because it's about us. This is a thoroughly a portrait of New York. These are sanitation workers who were walking on the street on their rounds and decided that shouldn't be in the garbage and took it back and made a display of it. You don't choose. But what they choose is not what you would choose to anoint as an object that's worthy.
Although I'm not sure I want somebody deciding which of my garbage should be put in a museum and which should be just put in a landfill.
It's out of your hands. It's a sanitation worker's superpower. You can't do anything about it.
What kinds of things are there?
You can find, there's a huge category of what you might call art that's just plain not good enough. I don't know how to describe it. Bad paintings, paintings that aren't bad in an interesting way, just simply not very sightly. There's a ton of knickknacks and crazy objects and weird stuff. They have an entire weight room, for example, that's just garbage. It's a weights that they retrieve from the track.
There was a guy who used to go and collect Bob Dylan's garbage. He called himself a garbologist many years ago. Didn't make Bob Dylan very happy, but perhaps he has a room in the museum. He also lists poultry markets, Russian baths, a pistol range, a hidden subway entrance, a memorial for Topsy the Elephant, a dollhouse that contains miniature versions of famous paintings like New Descending the Staircase.
By the original artist, that's the important thing.
Duchamp did it, thumbnail.
I have a friend who works at the Guggenheim who assured me that this is not in the catalogue raisonné of Duchamp. It slipped their notice. But Duchamp really did a tiny painting, about 2 by 3 inches, a copy of New Descending a Staircase, signed Duchamp, and it hangs on the wall of a dollhouse in the Museum of the City of New York.
Let's slip another call in here. Wesley from Park Slope, how are you on the air?
Yes,
you have to
hi.
Make it quick.
Yes. Interesting site on 3rd Avenue and 7th Street in Brooklyn. There's the site where over 300 Maryland volunteers died during the Revolutionary War of 1776 in August. And they were holding action against British troops coming down on the main force of the Continental Army. And it's not marked, really.
So how do you know about it?
Oh, well, it's well known in the neighborhood for with old-time residents. It's only marked. There's a sign on 9th Street above 3rd Avenue in American Hall that describes this area's history and the Battle of Brooklyn. Somewhere down there is the grave of over 300 volunteers from Maryland. It's never been located. Obviously, it's one of the most historical sites in the United States.
Now, there are probably a lot of cemeteries in New York that we still don't know about. They found that the Negro Cemetery at City Hall. There are a couple of Jewish cemeteries. There may be graves right below the building we're in.
Yeah, most famously, Washington Square Park supposedly has thousands of unmarked graves below.
Now, a listener called in to say that sign, "Don't Even Think of Parking Here," was by Mayor Koch. There's also no parking, no stopping, no standing, no kidding.
Wow, I'd love to find where that is to take a picture of it.
Meanwhile, we have a lot more things in this book, these two books, that we can't get to because we've run out of time. But my great thanks to T.M. Reeves for being our guest to talk about Secret New York, An Unusual Guide, and also Curious Activities, both of them published by John Glez, JONGLEZ, with lots of pictures. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having me. It was great to be here.